Welcome. Good afternoon. Thank you for all being here. We're going to talk about OT cyber challenges, but not only that, we'll also be talking about what is OT. And to do that, I have my friend who will introduce himself.
Yeah, I'm Rob Verzijde. So I work already for a couple of years in the OT environment. Originally as an engineer, an embedded engineer. But yeah, in 2006 that changed for me. I suddenly slipped into cybersecurity in OT environment. And yeah, I did not manage to escape that yet, so so I'm doing that still.
Yeah, my name is Ad, and I also work in OT, but I started out as an engineer, and I'm officially still an engineer. My tasks have grown over the years, and there's a lot of extracurricular activities that I do. So when something is not just standard work, I might be involved, and that also includes security, and that's where we have an overlap. But we started talking last year at Hacker Hotel a little bit, and then a few weeks later there was Dimitri's birthday. Some of you might be there as well, might have been there, and we got to talk to a fella who was working in pharmaceuticals, and he had questions. He wanted to have a feel of, okay, OT stuff, OT security, pharma. Can you tell us something about that? Yeah, sure, we probably can. We never heard from the guy again.
No.
But we kept talking about it a little bit every now and then, like, we could do something with this. Yeah, so yeah. We made a plan. We scheduled meetings weekly, and then kept canceling them because
every
we were
other
busy.
Week.
Yeah. And yeah. Now it's the weekend of Hacker Hotel, so here we are.
Yeah, so now we are ready.
Yep. If there are burning questions, sorry guys, please raise your hand and we'll provide you with a microphone. So we were talking about, okay, what would we actually put in the presentation?
Yep.
Well, first we started, okay, what have you been doing the last few weeks? Is there something in there that we could use? What have you been doing the last months? And we soon realized, okay, we work for different employers. And they had no say in this. They were not part of this.
They know we're doing this.
Yeah,
they
know, and that's it. I'm going with the competitor on stage. Bye, boss. Okay.
Exactly that.
And we realized some of our customers are actually the same.
Yep.
The industries we provide services to are the same. And the things we come across are the same. So... what we did, kind of, was get all the stories, squish them together, and get the core out of it.
Yeah.
So what we are telling are true stories, things based on reality, but not exactly like I'm going to say it's that customer that year and that happened.
Yeah. No reference to our customers itself. I don't think that they are quite happy with that. If there is anything in there, then I know for sure that that there is no problem there. But the stories that we use, or at least the reference we use, are all from the real life. So let's go to the next one.
Yeah. So what's
OT?
Yeah. What is OT? I think everybody has seen factories from the outside. And if you look on Street View or just drive through cities, you see buildings with stuff. And if there's a recognizable brand on the top of the building, you probably think, okay, they make this or that. They make screws or they make cars or whatever.
They make stuff.
If you go on Google Maps, you might be lucky and see some pictures from the inside. But still, what is this? Well, what you need to have OT, and first let's go into what is OT literally. It's operational technology. Information technology that we're all familiar with has to do with information, with data. An email is data. A database is data. Your Excel sheet is data. This is operational. So what this does is technology that changes, that operates on something physical.
Yeah.
it changes the material. It makes cookies from dough. It makes a door from a flat plate of steel. Yeah. So that's why it's operational. And what you use for that are mostly PLCs, SCADA systems, and DCS systems. How many people have used any of these three things? Ooh.
Nice.
More than we expected. Well, then we can just dive in. What's a PLC? And a PLC is basically a Arduino on steroids, a bit more luxury, but the origin is different, very different. Way back, you had mechanical machines with a central axle, with a drum, with some pegs or cams that were followed by levers and sticks and wires, and that made stuff work. Then you got some relays involved in there and actual machines with giant cabinets full of relays to control the machine, and that evolved into this PLC. It's inputs, outputs, and some logic in between to blend it all together. The way you program it, there you really see the history, there you see where it came from. One of the ways to program it is ladder logic, which closely resembles schematics you used for relay control. So there's that. You have them really small, like on the left, or modular, giant installations on the right. And these can also be expanded with more remote stations that have even more and more and more and more and more. Or you get extra colors involved. And this is also something different from an Arduino. These are safety PLCs. And that is machine safety, but also very much human safety. So if the email server crashes, you have no email. Okay, you reboot, and hopefully within 5 minutes, you have email. If this machine tears off a limb, you have a problem. And potentially lethal accidents. So safety PLCs have a lot of extra stuff on board to provide a very safe way of functioning, even if something is wrong. So there's actually two processors in one box with inverse logic, checking each other, and stuff like that. Then we have, next to the PLCs, the SCADA that I mentioned earlier. That is supervisory control and data acquisition, and that is used to view what is happening with the PLCs and with the machines that are operating on your things, on your products, or the process installation that is making pudding from raw milk and some other stuff. And there's an old guy sitting in front of a couple of screens here. They get bigger. And if they get impressively big, you might call it a DCS. And that is something that Rob has a lot of information on.
So if you look at SCADA is basically, you have a lot of machines that have their own control. And with SCADA, you look remotely to what the machine is doing, and you can change the speed and other settings. You can do that remotely. So it might also be on the same factory, or it might be geographically in long distances. But if your factory gets seriously big, then sometimes you need also control in between the factories, and then you're going to have the controllers centrally placed, and the actuators and sensors, so what you measure and what you control, is more remotely for the controller itself. Then you look like the larger factories. So most of the factories that have that are then the chemical plants, petrochemical plants. If you look over here in Rotterdam, you have many, many factories with the larger DCS systems. Still, the DCS systems can still control or also send messages to local PLCs. Because if you have, for instance, power generation, that a lot of cases that is more a small unit with control on it. So you have also hybrid configurations. But generally, if you look at the control rooms, you see also larger screens. You see much more complex on a high view. You see more complex systems then is actually generally is controlled with SCADA. So let's see, because I saw a lot of hands. So let's see how many. I have four over here. Those are not the newest systems, but who recognizes at least one of them? You can tell me the name of it.
Someone is doubting, I think, or not?
It's I.O.
Yeah? Want to hazard a guess?
Do you know the name of the system? Of one of those systems?
Siemens? The right one.
Siemens? That's
yeah?
Yeah? So which one? which one is Siemens? Because, yeah, that's it's just a guess. Right bottom? Left bottom is not Siemens. Right bottom is Siemens.
Yep.
Yeah.
This one.
So if you heard about the Siemens PLCs, S7 is a lot of people know that. This is his predecessor, S5. But there's also an the top right. Does anyone recognize that one? No, it's not ABB.
No. Though they look kind of similar.
Yeah.
I have to agree.
So yeah. the right top is originally Texas Instruments. It's System 505, but later bought by Siemens. So it's also known as Siemens TI-505. So that's why I asked which one. The down left, that's Delta V. That's from Emerson. The top left is Yokogawa Centum, an old DCS system. So you look at the systems. This is the smaller part. Generally, you have a whole cabinet filled of these. The right two, so the two on the right are both PLCs. On the left side are both our DCS systems. So if you just to look at it, you need to know if it's actually a DCS or a PLC. But generally, these have a lot of remote I/O and local I/O, and the controllers on the left side and the power on the left side. And these are really old systems. I believe this one do not have even TCP/IP connectivity or that kind of stuff. So that's if you only see this and there's no connectivity above, then it's quite easier to keep it cyber secure. But so.
Well, going to the security part.
So what is so special? A lot of cases you see those triangles. I see them everywhere, and the way people explain it, it's always different. But what we normally see, if you look at the IT, the confidentiality is quite high. Yeah, if you look at the entire, you have your secrets and so on systems, and if you see something happening, then you can say, okay, it might be not that nice or a nuance, then, but you can at least switch down your servers if you need to make sure that no one can get away with your data. So the integrity and availability, although in cloud and so you hear availability is quite important. Availability in the OT environment is not negotiable. If availability is gone, it can you might have people might lose their lives, or you might have environmental impact or that kind of crap. So you cannot lose control. So confidentiality is still important. It's very important, but it is the last of our concerns generally. Yeah, we cannot unplug this. So you need to make sure that you have different kind of controls in place. So if you have something that's confidential, you can protect it in a different manner, but you cannot unplug the power or something like that.
The safety PLC we saw earlier, the one with the pretty colors, that can also use Ethernet to communicate with remote I/O stations. So, for example, a larger line that stretches out more than this room will have emergency stop buttons all along the line, which are communicating over Ethernet. You do not want your colleague on the other end being eaten by the machine, and you go, oh, yeah, the switch is rebooting. Sorry, you have to wait.
Yeah.
So it's very critical to always have the connection between all the parts of the machine, especially the safety system.
Yep.
And you have to make decisions. And in IT, most of the time, a safe decision is let's switch it off and see what happened, and then we'll see if we can switch it on. Here we have a little example that is not so simple and clear cut. And I hope the audio works. This is a steel factory. And this is a giant paperclip. Yes. Do not lick this.
No.
But keep it going.
Yeah.
Which sounds weird. You heard the siren go off? All the people are gone. They are already out of this part of the factory. Why would you keep it running? I heard something?
It welds itself shut.
Exactly. It'll weld itself shut if you leave it inside the machine. And that also provides other difficulties in other situations. You can't just say, switch it off. Sometimes you need to keep it going. What if you have a very hot process and an exothermic reaction? If you stop everything, it'll just thermal run away. So you need to keep something going. How do you switch on the cooling? Through the network.
Yeah, think about power generation. Yeah. Are we going to switch off the power generation, like a couple of megawatts? It's don't want to do that just in a, if it's not necessary. So we
saw the extreme conditions here in the steel factory. It's hot, it's noisy, and you need to think about what do I do when things go wrong. In this case, keep it going, but get the people out is one of the things you want.
Yeah.
Like I said in the beginning, this started because someone from pharmaceutical industry wanted to know more. And in pharma, there's a different problem, and that's laws. You need to be able to provide traceability for every step in your production process, for every bit you put inside your medication. And the traceability is key, and in food, it's also a thing. I do work for several different food and beverage companies, and if the process is running blind without data being historized during the process, that batch might not be, you can't sell it on the market, because you can't guarantee that between 315 and 325 the temperature was still exactly within spec. And if you make a large truck full of fluid and you have those few minutes in between of uncertain quality, the batch is ruined. So also from an economic standpoint, you need to have that traceability.
Yeah. Just imagine what that means. So if you look at the box where you have your medication, there's a number on it. With a number, they can trace back entirely where all the stuff came from to make that batch. Yeah, so up to where it originally was grown, or all the transport, all the, it doesn't matter which truck, what time, all the machines that made it in the stuff in between and later. Everything is traceable.
Yeah, and to make it extra fun, the USA has different laws from Europe. Yeah. So you have to have different things logged for the different continents. The Chinese have their own requirements for traceability. But that's when you have food or medicine, stuff you ingest. There's also stuff you don't want to touch, like the hot bit, but also gas, fuel, stuff that can explode, dust, which is also sometimes part of the production process for other materials, but dust is a nasty one. Imperial Sugar had a bit of a problem a bunch of years ago, where their factory basically folded itself inside out because of a dust explosion. That was sugar, and if you have a sugar cube and you put a lighter to it, not that much happens immediately. If you have a dust cloud of sugar, it'll explode. If you have a dust cloud of metal filings, it'll explode. So dust is something to take a lot of care of, and that has implications for how you design your system. Critical infrastructure, that is something we definitely know in the IT as well. It's critical. It should not go down. If you have a pipe going from one country to the other, providing natural gas, there's a lot of monitoring. There's a lot of decisions to be made if they're going to provide the gas. We've seen that a couple of years ago. And it's non-interruptible. It says so on the slide. If something goes wrong there, we have a problem.
Then other differences. I'll just sometimes you use the words differently. Yeah. So there's a lot of what I see in practice. There's a lot of misunderstanding between the IT and the OT departments in larger companies. And most of the cases, if you just listen to them, they are basically both right. They do not understand each other, and they do not take the time to listen to each other. And I just lifted one out that happens. Just a difference between a host, a system, and an asset. So, can anyone give an example of how these words are different? How they can be different in an environment? Because if I talk to IT people, if you look at a computer, this is a computer, it's a host, it's an asset, it needs to be in an asset inventory, it's a system, everything is the same apparently. And from my experience in the OT environment, it's not.
Yes. So
a system has more cables
attached? Might be. Does anyone have another guess? No? It's just, I made a drawing. It's, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh.
From point A to point B, that is,
instead of a system, as in, I have one machine. That's
yeah, could be. Yeah, could be. Yeah. So the one I give you right now is the one I see the most. It's not always 100% crystal clear. This is the one I see the most. When we talk about a host or that kind of stuff, it's a lot of times it's just one of the computers. If you talk about the system, it can be the entire DCS system controlling the entire part of that factory. And if you talk about the entire factory, they talk about the asset. So the one asset in a company, a petrochemical company, is generally one of the plants. Yeah. And if you talk about a system, that is one. If you have one of the larger factories in Rotterdam, you have one asset has 13 factories on it. And all these factories have their own systems in there. So, and if you just talk about this, and people talk about system, but you really mean a host and that kind of stuff, you get right the weirdest conflicts in just talk.
There's a question.
Cool.
Is a production line then similar to a system?
Yeah, could be.
In most cases, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the difference might be that the production line, you say, then it might be also look at the machines itself, like the pumps and valves, and then look at the system. But that depends sometimes on the company. If they say, well, the valves and the pumps and that kind of stuff is part of it as well. But at least gives you an idea that there might be just a challenge in language. So that kind of... So...
Acme. We all know this guy, and we're going to use it a bit to showcase our fictitious company based on some real stories and real client activities that we've seen. And this company makes things, anvils. We've seen those plenty of times. And to make anvils, for example, you need a couple of steps. You do something with the metal and smelting and making it into the shape, and then you have to pack it in a box and put it on a pallet with a bunch of them and ship them. And the part where you deal with fluids, liquids, we usually talk about processing, while the part where you make it into the anvil and package it, that is manufacturing, and that goes per piece instead of a batch of something. So there's a bit of processing in ACME, and there's a bit of machine control in there. And for the OT environment at ACME, they started small, and there was a lot of manual labor, and then they had a little machine that helped with the packaging, and then they had a second machine added, and they just had a little wire with a signal high-low. Like, okay, it's on, yeah, okay, and then that one cannot go on as well. And that grew. They grew a lot, and then there was a manufacturer that said, well, I can give you the entire packaging line, all four machines, and we just put a switch there in the corner and hook those four up, and then they can communicate. Sure. And then the office said, well, would it be great if we can put the orders from the sales department onto the machine? Yeah, sure. Okay. Put in the wire. And that's where the problem started. Suddenly you had a managed switch because IT said, yeah, you need to use managed switches. So they got it out of the box and it's a big one. Plug in the power, plug in the network ports, and be done. So that's managed, right? They needed to connect it to the office. Plug it in. It's connected now, right? Luckily we do things differently now. So they had some issues. So, okay, where are we now with ACME? Are they on the edge of the abyss? Are they going to plummet into non-existence? Are they getting hacked tomorrow? Well, maybe not. Just let's just start a journey. Like, let's see how can we make ACME great again. Oh, by the way. A couple of weeks ago, we had this ICS advisory about the Rockwell Automation Factory Talk Activation Tool. That is the licensing system for Rockwell PLC software. And that was a CVSS of 9.8. So maybe you need to do something with that as well. IT didn't know they had this software.
No. So what can he do?
Where do we start? Yeah.
And that's the problem. What can you do? So the thing is, and sadly, I do this more since 2006. So it's quite a couple of years. I'm doing this already, and still I find factories where they have similar situations. Yeah, luckily it's not the larger companies anymore, but they're still there. So the first thing that we actually start with every time again is I just ask what do you have? Yeah, what's in your factory? And sadly enough, they rarely have any documentation that is complete or up to date or whatever. So then we ask them, well, if you want to make the right decisions, find out what you actually need to do to be more resilient in the future and to have more maintainable. You have to know exactly what you have. And so in an accurate asset inventory, it's not just a list of machines that you have. It's everything in there. What is the type? So it's the computer, it's the PLC. What's the make? But also, who's the owner? Who delivered it? Who installed it?
Is there a service agreement?
Is there a service agreement? All these kind of stuff. All your identifiers, because of course you cannot have one identifier. You have multiple. Yeah, there's most of the cases there's a unique identifier on the PLC that you can find with the manufacturer. If it talks TCP/IP, then there might be an IP address or a MAC address and so on. And you have a lot of identifiers. You need to know them all. Also the dependencies. If one machine fails, is there anything else that will stop as well? But also, if I have a server, there might be multiple services running on that. So if you're going to reboot that machine, who will have the trouble? Yeah, and of course, an asset inventory is never complete without the logical and the physical drawings. You need to know how your network is set up, how it's connected. So every time that we do a project, and this is not available, this takes at least half of our time to build this. Yeah, after that, we're going to do the other stuff. This is real time either. But yeah, you can also wait until you have an incident, and then an incident response company will come to help you. First thing they ask, do you know what you have? What is out there? And if you don't have it, they're going to build it for you, but probably a little bit more expensive. Then, what are the real? If you now finally have an overview what you have over there, you can finally look at what is vulnerable out there. What do you have? What is quite old and might be vulnerable? So, what are the actual threats that you have? So, you're going to think in threat scenarios. And of course, the hacker is a popular one, and the malware is a popular one. But most of the cases is just, say, 80% of it is just one of your employees making an honest mistake. Yeah, that might cause a failure as well. So you want to be prepared for everything, so you can easily bounce back.
Or just something breaks.
Yeah, so
happens.
Hardware
quite a lot.
Fails. Yeah. So if you virtualize your whole factory, you have redundancy in the virtualize. Make sure it does not run on one piece of hardware. And it sounds like a joke, but it actually it happens. Yeah. So that's and then. Of course, if you want the potential impact on the threat scenarios, then you can decide what needs to improve here. So this is one of the examples that we use to give you an idea what the threat scenario is. So for instance, a lease line running through the ocean to the plants actually dug up. Recently, we heard that there were a couple of wires were separated basically. They were cut. These things happen. Yeah, there's not always malintent, but it can happen. Another one: operator accidentally reboots an essential machine. Sometimes people work remote, and it is not rare that someone reboots the wrong machine. Yeah, so they think that they are logged into the right machine, but they are logged in and on a jump server onto the next one, and then they reboot the wrong one.
Who has not ever rebooted the wrong machine? I see one. Congratulations.
One smooth, nice.
Yes.
Nice. This is a cool one. Yeah. Elephants accidentally crushed the network fiber cables, facilitate connectivity between process control and components. What we just said, this is real life. This is an actual one, but I really like this one. So yeah, so there's a situation where somehow, like elephants can smell water. Apparently, they find fiber optics in the sand as well, and they find it funny to play with it. So, this is a real world scenario. It's a funny one. And then, of course, your disgruntled employee. This is still in there. Your threat can also be inside. So, and now, how can we then make sure that the impact is as little as possible? Well, I work a little bit longer in the OT than there was cybersecurity in the OT. So when we started to find out at the time what we can do, we just started, what do we have already? What can we use as a benchmark on threats? And it might be that a couple of you already saw something like this. This is from safety, process safety. Yeah, because there were big accidents in the past. So you need to figure out how can you lower the actual impact. Personally, I do most of my work in the critical infrastructure and a lot of chemical factories. So the first two are most in what I like to hear is that at least most cases they are the most important ones they look at. The other ones are also important, but if you have the probability loss of life, people with injuries. And you, the red is where you do not want to be. Yeah, absolutely not. And in the light blue, that's the nicest part to be at. But it doesn't happen all the time. So what you want to know is how likely is it that it can happen? Will it happen just once in a year, or is it never heard of, or that kind of stuff? But also then, if it happens, what is the maximum consequence? And if it's it's possible that you have nothing to do. There's no damage or to people or to the environment, but it might be that your production stops and you have a loss of, for instance, 1 million, something like that. And then you, yes, and then it is something, okay, what do you, if you know these figures, then you can decide on, do I spend $1,000 to make sure that I end up over here? That might be an easy decision if the if it can happen a couple of times in a year. Yeah, if it's something that there's more than 10 million, but it happens only once in 50 years, then you come, okay, how much do I need to spend on that? Is that more than 10 million and so on? Do I really want to spend it on it? Or so these kind of things. So this is what we generally use. Then if you, when you finally know what the current status is, you can also look for, is there a way to make sure that it is gets less likely or that the impact is less? And we impact, of course, you do that for all the four separately. People who saw safety in the past as well might recognize this bow tie as well. On the left side, you have the hazard. So there is something in the threat scenario that is threatening you. And the top event, well, it's in green, but it's a really that's the bad event that you want to make sure that it doesn't happen. And the likelihood that it's going to, you can place barriers over here to make sure that it doesn't end up over there. But it looks basically like Swiss cheese. So if you have all the holes over here in the barrier still lined up, yeah, the top event's going to happen. And if the top event is going to happen, you want to make sure that the consequences are low as possible. So you can have then think about different barriers that are going to make sure that the consequence is lower. And if we project this to cybersecurity, it looks a bit like this. Yeah. So the you can prepare yourself, so you can make sure that people are trained, so they know what to do. You can make sure that you know what you actually have, what the threats are. You can prevent worst by making sure, that, or prevent that it's going to happen, to make sure that you have regular patch management and not, as you hear, once in a year or twice a year. You can design your environment so you can patch like an IT environment as well. And then you make if you have access control in place and all these kind of things, you may then still the top event can happen, but it gets less likely that it happens. And of course, detection. Well, if the top events happen, it's clear. Yeah, but if it's not that clear, then hopefully you have monitoring in place. So you can see if processes fail, or you can see that that there is an anomaly going on, or and hopefully you're collecting event logs as well. And eventually you want to respond. So with network architecture, for instance, you can make sure that the area is not one flat network, but it is segmented in smaller pieces. So if there is, for instance, malware, hopefully you can just make sure it is, and it gets introduced one way or another in your factory, it only limits it to one small to one small segment. And if you have what you like to do is basically if you have if you look at the IT environment, you have duplication of some of the functions. Yeah, so you make sure you have redundancy in there. If your one system reboots, the function is not gone. It's one server that provides that function is not gone. Yeah, is gone and not not the entire function. That's what you want to do over here as well. Yeah, it's what we call graceful degradation. I don't know if you know that term, but you can look at it as an escalator. So if an escalator runs, normally you can just go up or down. But if an escalator stops functioning, at least stops rolling, there's still stairs. So it still it provides a function, less comfortable, but it's, you can still do deal with it.
There's also a reason why in big control rooms you often see two stations that have a specific task dedicated to them, but they have one screen from the other guy as well.
Yeah.
So if one part dies, you can still do all the essential functions from the other station as well.
Yep.
And the SCADA servers are usually redundant. So maybe you have like a few seconds glitch while switching over, but that is something you can plan. So if you really want something to keep working, you can build around that. And that is also one patch management. It used to be you can't patch OT because you can't turn it off. unfortunately, the old Acme, that was the case. New Acme, you have to make sure that when designing, you get the recover and the respond designed the way that you can patch, and then it is possible.
That is definitely possible. Yeah, so imagine if the operator stage that he mentions, that if you look at the DCS systems, you have a lot of screens, but you make sure that maybe two of the four operator stages you have is on a different network segment than the other two, then maybe you have two failing, but the other two are still available. And so you're not completely without a view on your process. Yeah, of course, your backup needs to be designed on the thread. Yeah, you can imagine if you have regular backups and you store it on network storage that's always available, because the same network storage that's always available is not going to help you against malware, because malware will find that as well. So for different scenarios, you will implement different kind of backups. And from my point of view, you do not have a backup until you at least try and practice to make sure that you restore it as well. Yeah, because you need to know, are you restoring it well, and so on. And at some point, you will have all your policy procedures ironed out how to deal with this, and you get much more relaxed, because you know if anything goes wrong, you can still fix it. Well, you know how much time it's going to cost you, you know exactly where the backups are stored, because you can have backups, but you have no clue where they are. Then basically you have no backups available.
Version control.
Version control as well, yeah. So one of the things that we generally do is if there's an entire new plant, entirely gone, we make sure that all the data that you have at that moment, all the documents, every firmware that's in the PLCs, everything is stored on at minimum two, preferably three copies. Yeah, just walk into a shop, buy an SSD of 2 terabytes or so. They are not as expensive anymore. But the USB is an interface that probably is still there in 10 years or so. Just buy a couple, and then one you have to on all you have exactly the same copy. One is in locally stored in the safe with a label on it. Never touch it again. Only in an absolute emergency situation. You have a similar copy somewhere in a safe offsite. Yeah, again, don't touch it again. And the third one is if you still need access or to the documents and so on for whatever reasons. But preferably the other one, you never touch them. And the next time you have a major update in your system, you're going to buy new SSDs, new labels. Yeah. Do never touch those the other ones again. Unless you want to make the decision to fall back to the original situation where you originally started. Yeah, so you have always something to as a catch, a net.
There's a question.
Yes?
How long, in your opinion, will a typical SSD will stay alive? Still readable.
Good question. I've seen SSDs that the early SSDs after 5 years they're still alive. So the actual duration that they were still alive, I don't know. They're better readable than tape. And the problem with tape is you have to make sure that you find a tape streamer as well at some point that is still compatible. Yeah. So as far as I know, I don't know if you have to know the.
It's usually years, and in a strategy where you have factories that will evolve every year quite substantially, or every 2 years, you make new ones. And if after 4 or 5 years you doubt, just make sure it's in the plan. You buy new ones, copy the data onto there.
Yeah.
And then you have 6 backups. Great.
Thanks.
Yeah. And then at some point you have your backups and that kind of stuff. But for the incident response as well, it's your own incident response. So not as a... for everything that might, any incident that might happen. Yeah, so also someone who accidentally plugs in his laptop in the wrong network connector and it still connects for whatever reason. Yeah, so you need to know what do you need to detect that. So you need some kind of detection system, you need monitoring. You need monitoring on what is actually running normally, but also everything that is out of the ordinary. And those are different kind of monitoring systems.
Yeah, and one of the big difference between IT and OT there is normally would say, okay, I see something that it might be abnormal on my network, so I kill it with fire. Or I see something weird happening on the network. There might be something weird going on in the factory and they are fixing stuff. If the factory is running normally, something breaks and I come there with a service laptop and I'm trying to diagnose and troubleshoot the problem, my laptop is the weird thing. I'm trying to fix the shit, so don't kick me off. So there is, again, in the exact decision making, there's might be a difference between IT and OT.
And then you make what? Then you also prepare what you do. You need to recover. You have it documented. So in your practice. So you know everyone knows what to do. So if you have all these insights, you do your designs and you do your proper answer, it's much more relaxed there. So if you ever heard about the IEC 62443, this basically the majority of controls that you have you find in there are in this picture as well. No. So, how does ACME do now? So they're finally everything implemented. So, first of all, they better understand their risks, because most of the cases, they act. If you talk to people, they actually know that there are certain risks, but they're not aware. So you make sure that they are finally aware of the actual risks. And there are generally more risks than people think there are. They're not that... they're not Hollywood-style risk there, but there are risks you want to make sure that if you can do anything about it, that you're going to do something about it.
Yeah, for a little example, not really on the security side, but more on the manufacturing side. If I ask an operator on a packaging line, what is the risk he runs during his shift from getting his KPIs, it's the boxes keep getting snagged in the machine. If I ask the maintenance guy, what is the risk that they don't tell me that the machine has been running for 24 hours and I need to grease the machine again? So you get, whoever you ask, you get a completely different answer. But it all could end up in production loss. No. And in security, depending on who you ask, you get a different answer, but it could end up in the top incident.
Well, system health is visible. If you have monitoring in place that tells you, for instance, that a certain service on a server is running and it's running okay, if you feed the operator or the engineer with that, they can just start their day with just looking at, okay, is there anything that failed right now in my redundancy? No, everything is in green. Nice. Hopefully it's going to be a relaxed day. Yeah. The regular maintenance is finally possible or gets easier. If you're still here, well, we cannot patch because we do not know what will fail. If you have an old environment where you have one machine that is actually called critical, you cannot, after redesign of your network or you have a new factory, I'm not going to take you seriously. If it's critical, then you have at least two or three of them. So that means you can patch them as well, because you calculate in that you're going to reboot the system regularly. And that's not only for those systems. Your network equipment are basically computers as well, just more network interfaces. Those need regular firmware updates as well. Yeah, just to go back to one of the Angry Nerd talks about Fortinet, then you know it. These need to be patched as well, and not only outside. So make sure you have, if it's on a critical place, these are redundant as well.
Yeah, just don't update them both core switches at the same time.
No.
Please.
No. No.
And the excuse from India saying, but it's outside office hours. Yeah, but it's a 24/7 production plant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
And we have an example where you have four-fold redundancy because it's highly critical. And what IT from India does, one switch fails. They go to the next switch, it fails. They go to the next data center, it fails. And then guess what happened with the fourth one? And then it was a public holiday over here. Everyone's called back because all the network connectivity in the Netherlands, part of the UK and the North Sea was gone.
Oops.
Yeah. So human stupidity is not always easy to factor in. So the warning system for irregularities and potential incidents. So what you call in IT the IDS, yeah, the We generally call it anomaly detection. It's still the same system. It's just used slightly different. So instead of the intrusion detection, well, hopefully if you have multiple layers, there shouldn't be any intruders, but you want still to see anomalies, wrong configurations, machines that are connected somewhere you don't want to have them. Everything is out of the ordinary because it can also tell you that the hardware is about to fail. See that? Yep. Okay, 5 minutes. Well, we're almost there. No, okay. 5 minutes. We're almost there. Okay. So they're also prepared to contain an incident and limit the consequences because they now know what to do. So if we mentioned the Rockwell incident, we now know what to do. We can handle it. Yeah, we're not scared of that. We're just going to do it the way we practice already.
We have a list where this software is installed. We have a list, hopefully, which version is actually running at this moment. So we know, okay, we need to do this, this, and this machine. You know what? There's a project going on in that side of the factory, and they are using this machine, so we'll leave that one till after the weekend, and first we'll do the other two machines.
Yep. So, cool stuff. So, basically only spouse sounds more relaxed, right? Questions?
There's a question over there.
Yep.
So the anomaly detection, is that still a process of manually setting the boundaries and the parameters of normal operation and then alerting when it goes outside? Or is it also a bit more clever, like statistical detection against a baseline or a combination of those?
Statistical detection against the baseline is of what you already have right now.
Okay, what tools are available for that?
There are multiple tools about it. There is, for instance, Forescout has their equipment that you can do that.
TX1.
You have Nozomi, and these are the manufacturers that actually are specialized in OT environments. So they also recognize the OT protocols that are used. Yeah, they can also show you the network that is detected just by. You can start just listening on your network. Yeah, what is going on? You start baselining. Of course, at start you need to figure out. You always have a couple of outliers that you need to check if that's correct. And once you have that baseline, then everything out of the ordinary is going to be shown, reported.
One of the things those vendors do say is, no. We start with detection. We do not immediately turn on the prevention because we don't want to accidentally kick off the wrong stuff.
No.
That is something special, I think, for the OT side more than
actually, if you see prevention in generally, that's the DMZ going to the office connection. You can cut that off without interruption production. But if you do an interruption in the production environment itself, you might have an availability issue with all kinds of consequences you don't want.
Okay, other questions? Here in the front, there's a cube coming your way. Watch out.
All these production lines you are talking about, are they mandatory need to have a CE mark?
Yep, I think so, yep.
And if they have a CE mark, then you are already at 90% of what you just read to do?
Would have been nice, but no.
How do they get this mark?
Made in China.
Most China. There's a bunch of off-the-shelf products you smoosh together, and then it's a system. There's the word again. But it's not a CE validation for the entirety as one. It's the parts, and they have all CE markings.
Yes, but mostly you need to have this system also validated for a CE mark. I'm talking of own experiences with building a bridge, and there are also certifications for a bridge.
Yep.
And you have to make sure that you have all the risk analysis and stuff in place to get this CE mark.
Yeah, but the CE doesn't tell you to have separate VLANs for this and that.
If you want, there are different kinds of certifications. One certification is, for instance, your safety system. Yeah, the most of the chemical factories, they have a certification on their on the safety system itself. They test when the factory is still off that it actually functions as it is supposed to designed to do. Yeah. And your license to operate on your factory is based on that. So it's actually when you finally have everything in the green, they allow you to start up the factory, not before. And that is also a difficulty because that means that you cannot update those systems when your factory is still running. Those sort of systems are well well shielded generally. Yeah, but yeah, you have different kind of requirements on the certifications, yes. But for instance, the monitoring stuff generally doesn't have that. It just bolts onto, and generally this is just passive, just passive listening. So they should not influence the factory if everything is correctly configured, of course. Oh.
Okay. Oh. Yes. Any more? Yes.
Can we have more video of failures that happen in OT?
Oh, yes. There are plenty.
Yes.
Not on this laptop right now, but I can show you plenty of them. Yes.
We maybe do next year a little workshop. We'll just go watch videos for an hour and a half.
Just a bloopers reel or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
That's it. No more questions?
No more questions? Well, thank you.
Thank you.